welcome to another edition of the Sports Pro Podcast. I'm Tom Bassam, back after a week off in which the hot seat was very ably filled by my colleague Katie Preston, who had a fascinating conversation with Gemma Waugh, who's from the MKTG agency, but also a member of our Sports Pro New Era class for 2023-24. If you haven't listened to it yet, I really strongly recommend you do. It was a conversation all about how women make the sports industry a better place to be. Now, on this week's show, we feature an interview that I did recently with the CEO of the England and Wales Cricket Board. That's Richard Gould. Richard Gould joined the England cricket body in 2021 after serving the same position at Bristol City Football Club, but he previously has plenty of experience in the game, having been chief executive of both Somerset and Surrey. Now, in our conversation, we covered all things cricket, including the IPL, the 100, the future of the test match format, and everything in between. I started off by asking Richard for his thoughts on the health of the county game.
I think the county game's in a good position. It's one of those formats of the game that's been around literally for 140, 150 years. Now, history's really important to us. That legacy, the fact that the clubs are so deeply rooted in the communities, the talent pathway that comes through it. It's all such an important aspect of what then we as a game hope to deliver, perhaps at the sharpest end, which will be our England men and women's teams. Sport can be a precarious existence, but we've never lost one of our county clubs in terms of going into administration or going out of business. And that's something that we're very proud of also. And so the county game, both for our men and women's teams, is the bedrock of our professional teams, all of them.
On the county game, to talk of it as one thing, I think is almost a little bit disingenuous in that you've got the T20 Blast, you have the county championship, and then on top of that, you've got the 102, which almost sits outside of the traditional county model. I'd like to start with the Blast. With that, obviously it's a T20 competition that kind of goes up against the 100. What's the future for that competition look like? Is that something that the ECB is still actively invested in, like, not just financially, but emotionally?
No, very much so, and emotionally as well. We've got the 100, which is currently played at 8 venues, both men and women's teams, and then we've got the county Blast, which is played across 18 clubs, but probably 22, 23 venues. And so that gives us our geographic spread in terms of the Blast. It's been going since 2003. Sometimes people will forget the impact that county cricket had in the creation of T20 all those years back in 2003. And that's really what primed the whole white ball T20 growth globally. And so it's got a very important future. Yes, we have another short form competition, the 100, which is our premier competition in terms of the concentration of talent and the investment that goes into it. But I'm very confident and comfortable having multiple competitions sitting alongside each other. It's what you see in sport. How many domestic competitions does a rugby club play in? Probably 4 a year. Ditto for a football club, whether it's the FA Cup, the league, the League Cup, the LDV Vans Trophy, all those sorts of things. You know, each competition slightly has its own context, but they're all valuable to us.
When you're, I don't think ranking them is the right way of thinking about it, but like, do some have to be given greater priority given that they, I mean, for example, like the county championship feeds the test team, the 100 doesn't feed a form of international cricket. How does that work?
Yeah, scheduling in cricket is, I mean, we could write books and books as to how the scheduling goes, but take, for example, 2017-2019, we hosted the Champions Trophy and the World Cup here in this country, and those competitions started in sort of middle of May. We then adjusted the domestic schedule, so we were playing 50-over white ball cricket domestically just in the lead-up to that. And I think that's where the county game and the domestic game really does provide a baseline and support for what happens internationally. And if I look at the amount of talent that we're creating as a country, it far exceeds any other country around the world. The proof point of that, if I look at the men's talent pool and all of the men that are playing in global T20 tournaments around the world, there are 75 English qualified players that played in the last 12 months around the world. The nearest country to us was Pakistan with 45. So you can see that when you look at the number of clubs and counties and teams that we've got, it's generating a very large talent pool. And in these uncertain times, you never quite know who's going to pop up with a franchise tournament next. Having a really strong talent pool provides us with a good base.
Isn't partly, though, that to do with the fact that India doesn't so much let its players go and play in those overseas tournaments, so there is more opportunity?
Yeah, definitely. Particularly in T20 tournaments, we do see Indian players playing in county cricket. But in terms of T20 tournaments around the world, the Indian players do not participate. And that is largely because the IPL is the biggest global tournament and they want to keep it that way. And I can understand that, otherwise they will have value leaching out from what they're trying to do.
And how do you protect against that all-encompassing growth of the IPL? I mean, it's a fantastic tournament.
Yeah, it is.
But its orbit seems to be ever-increasing. Its gravity seems to be ever-increasing. Do you have to be a bit protectionist as well?
We do have to protect our resources and our players and make sure they don't get burnt out and they get looked after. The IPL is the most important domestic tournament in the world in cricket, and at some stage, maybe the most important domestic tournament in all sports, such is the size and reach of that particular
market. They'll have a good old arm wrestle with the NFL, I think.
They will do. But in terms of views and all the rest of it, digital views, depends on what metric you use, it's kind of right up there. So, you know, we're very keen that all of our best players do get the opportunity to play in the IPL. It's great for them, it's great for their careers, and it's good for us. There are other competitions around the world that aren't so good for us, and therefore we need to make sure that we're paying our players the market rate so they don't feel as if they need to go and pack their bags every couple of weeks and go off, because ultimately it's not great for them. And it's not good for us also when we're preparing for our own international matches and international challenges. World Cup being an example, we've got the T20 Men's World Cup coming up later this year. The women have just come back from New Zealand. The life of a cricketer, particularly if they're playing domestic and international cricket, can be very, very busy.
My follow-up to that would be, how do you ensure that English cricket is producing the revenues in order to match the Indian revenues? I mean, that's really tough, right?
Yeah, that is tough. Most of our revenue is generated from Test cricket. We get amazing support from Sky, who have been long-term partners. Test cricket provides them with great content during the summer. On top of that, we've got the 100, which is generating new revenues, bringing new people into the game. All countries have a slightly different business model. And I think we're fortunate that we can have a very strong test offering and we can have a very strong white ball short format offering as well. And not all countries have got that. Now, that's something that obviously we're working with the ICC that we're very cognizant of, to try and make sure that value can be spread as widely as possible throughout the game, whilst ensuring that we've got enough money left in order to deliver on our intent and make sure we keep all our best players.
Why is it, do you think, that like England and Wales, obviously, is so good at generating interest in Test cricket compared to other countries? Even formerly really big Test playing nations like the West Indies, for example, you go to even some home tests in India, they don't get the same crowds and the same engagement that we get with Test cricket in this country. Are there lessons that the ECB can help with those other nations?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to try and preach to others, because they find their own way through. I think if you look at the West Indies Test team, they're touring here later on in the summer. They're bringing a very, very strong Test team, strongest possible Test team. They have historically lost some players to the short form competitions around the world, and that's because they have not been able to keep up with the market on that, and they haven't been able to necessarily afford to keep hold of their players, and therefore a lot of them have gone off. Kieran Pollard is a good example. That's where one of their struggles. In terms of what we do particularly well in this country, I think the customer experience in our venues is exceptional. It's a great day out.
It is.
Whether that's a 100 or a test, each venue has its slightly different feel to it. So if you go to Trent Bridge versus Lords, very different feel. And I think it's a very sociable occasion, going to cricket in England. And sometimes, for example, in India or Pakistan or Bangladesh, the facilities are probably developing still, but also they have very hot weather at times, which makes it not that comfortable to sit outside. So I think the customer experience is really important and really key.
I definitely think that's the case. When you go to test matches here, people will queue outside forever, sit through rain delays, etc. Is there a case for a bit of a rising tides thing here? If you were to go and assist in and say, look, we want to help with the kind of endurance of test cricket, that isn't going to happen if you guys aren't getting the people through the door and there isn't the interest in that game.
And this is where, if you look at what happened post-COVID or even during COVID, the England cricket team and indeed the Indian cricket team were the ones that were touring the most. And by touring, because the way the business model works is that the broadcaster revenue is retained by the hosting club. So the more we tour, the more we help in terms of broadcast revenue and also activities. And I think both the Indian teams and the England men's teams did an amazing job during COVID in coming out of it, in going out and playing. There were some countries that their players didn't leave their shores at all during that period. You know, I think by getting out there and playing those games all around the world, and we will continue to do it, it's done through the Future Tours plot, which is bound together with the World Test Championship. That gives us the best opportunity. But then, you know, countries have got to find their own way as well and find their own commercial model.
On the sort of the generating revenue side, obviously we talked about Test cricket there being a big one. We've mentioned the 100 in passing. Yeah. Investment in the 100 is something that has been discussed. What does that look like ideally? Like, is that individual teams being acquired by franchise owners? How does that work?
Yeah, it's something that we've been looking at for some time. We are an outlier when it comes to the way the 100 is currently run. It's run centrally at the moment, which was a really good strategy because it allowed the competition to get up to speed really, really quickly. But having everything run centrally, including budgets for players, etc., means that you do miss out on the energy, enthusiasm and money that private investment can bring in. And so we think that the next best way to further accelerate development of the game is to bring in private investment. And we've looked at options in terms of central investment into the competition. It's not something that we as a game want to look at further. We've been out on consultation since probably about June of last year, and that message has come through clear. And I think that message has come through because if we sell the competition, it feels like we're selling the summer, and we lose control of our own summer at that point. So that's not something that the game wants to do. So we're now looking at options to bring investment into teams. Those conversations are live at the moment, working out where the revenue streams would sit, where the risk sits. And the way that we're looking at the moment, there's probably two phases. The first one is that the teams have a closer involvement with the host counties and the non-host counties. We work out all those revenue shares. And then from there, there's the opportunity for investment into specific teams from third parties. So it'll take a bit of time to work through.
Just to clarify slightly, so the base teams where they are in those grounds right now, those counties will get a bigger share of the revenue. There'll be a split with the team investor and then a slightly smaller share for the counties that don't host 100 teams.
Those are the sorts of things that we are looking at, but we know the responsibility that the game has in order to fund the whole game, not just the top of the game. You see these arguments go on in all sports. You know, football at the moment is having discussions with regards to the share across its pyramid. Exactly those discussions are happening now. And we have a huge variety in terms of the clubs that we've got, in terms of size and different elements that they each bring to the game. And we just need to make sure that we harvest the revenue that we think can be generated. And then that money is spent in the game on behalf of the game to develop cricket.
And I guess you're always going to have those counties that aren't hosting those teams. There's going to be that push and pull relationship, right? They're going to want to make sure they get their cut too.
Yeah, absolutely. But what I see is a game that wants to stay together. You know, the fact that so many of our clubs are member owned means that I think the culture within the game is let's look after each other in that regard. Notwithstanding the fact that we need to make sure that those clubs, venues that are hosting, whether it's Test Match Cricket or the 100, have the financial firepower and the muscle to do the job that we want them to do. You know, this is always that argument. We always need to make sure that we've got enough money to compete in the global market to retain and attract the best players in the world. Otherwise, we're just arguing about the size of share of a smaller pie.
To that end then, I know before you joined the ECB, you were a bit of a 100 sceptic. Do you believe that the 100 can go and become, I mean, I think trying to overtake the IPL is a big ask, but certainly become a tier below that in terms of its appeal globally as a short-form cricket competition?
I think the IPL is not something that can be reeled in. Hmm. Look at the size of the market, 1.4 billion people. You know, nobody wants to say they want to be second best. So I think the way that we term it is that we want to be the number one challenger to the IPL, and that's not a bad place to be. But I think when you look at the history of sport in this country and the focus on clubs the way that we do things, whether it's promotion or relegation, or the way that we develop our talent, both men and women. Whilst economically, the IPL is unassailable, it's Mount Everest, there are other things that we think that we can do better and compete in other areas. So we're going to give it a best shot.
What are some of those things?
Look, talent development. Men and women playing at the same time on the same pitch. Accessibility. We're doing a lot to raise our game to ensure that we are accessible to all people within the country. And, you know, we've had some difficult times over the last 3 or 4 years, but those difficult times have helped to sharpen our focus as to what we need to be and what we want to be, which is the most inclusive sport. So there's some strengths for us to play on.
To come back to what we were discussing earlier about Indian players playing overseas, would you accept investment, say, from some of the IPL team owners into the 100 teams if you were able to get access to that playing pool as well? Or is that something that's not really on the agenda?
I think we've been talking about trying to get access to Indian players for many years. I don't see that changing at this stage. There is a lot of interest from Indian investors into English cricket through the England Wales Cricket Board, as there is from many other countries and many other sources. I don't see it necessarily as being a quid pro quo that Indian players are then made available.
But if that Indian investment were to come in and it was from IPL backers, they would want to have a say in a way that would suit probably the IPL, right? In the way that they have with the SA20 and Major League Cricket and the Caribbean Premier League.
Yeah, they'd want it to suit the needs of their own IPL franchise, not necessarily the needs of the IPL. It's interesting the number of IPL franchises that are looking to basically have groups of teams. And you see in other sports, you see in football where you have that group structure, and I can see benefit in having a group structure.
And with the broadcast side, the rights for the 100 are locked up until, is that 2027?
Yeah, at the end of 2028. So we've got a good run into that. We're just about to enter the new broadcast cycle, the new broadcast deal in 2025. So we've got a good degree of stability to build on. As I said, Sky have been amazing partners. We get great coverage from the BBC also. We think that we've got a really good mix of some cricket in front of the paywall and also clearly enough cricket behind the paywall to continue to allow us to invest in the game, not just at the top, but all the way through.
For the ECB, I guess going back out in front of that paywall, is that something you're like, oh, this is something maybe we should look at a little bit more if we can? Because that was a criticism for a long time, I think, after the 2005 Ashes, basically English Test cricket, we didn't see it again, apart from some very rare occasions. But the 100 was a great opportunity to take it away and bring that access back in and create a broader audience.
Yeah, the exposure is without doubt really important. The BBC do a really good job for us on that. Streaming is extremely important to us now. You know, the number of counties and clubs, both men and women's games that are streamed. Free to view. It's interesting if you look at the difference between our broadcast market and the Indian broadcast market. Most of UK sport is behind the paywall, and it is paid for by subscribers that want to be able to sit and watch from home. In India, it's largely free to view, but it's paid for by the advertisers.
Yeah.
And you've got this 1.4 billion size market that advertisers want to get in front of, and therefore the economics work through an advertising model, whereas ours is a subscription model. It would be interesting to see how that moves and develops, but I suspect the subscription model is a very strong model, and it provides us with a great deal of certainty that allows us to build on the game, create more value for our partners, and also grow the game.
With the 100 being a new game, though, do you see it staying in front of that paywall probably for the next cycle too?
We'll see what happens on the next cycle. Yeah, I wouldn't want to prejudge that.
Okay, fair enough. We've talked a lot about the men's game. I think that's really unfair. Sorry.
Totally.
The women's game, I find this is really exciting. The announcement very recently about the kind of the creation of the teams that are being attached to the new counties. I think there was a lot of chat about where the teams were and like who wasn't there. But what I want to know is, what are the formats that are going to be played? Is this included in Sky's broadcast deal? How are the public going to access it?
Yeah, the format will be T20 and 50 over format, as are played now by the regional teams. The regional teams were created 4 or 5 years ago to help pump prime the pathway effectively to try and bring the talent together and advance the women's game in terms of the quality of play. And that's been really successful. I think we had 20 women players playing around the world last year in franchise tournaments. If you go back to 2018-19, we only had 18 women on professional contracts in all of cricket. We've now said that we want to grow to 12 teams by 2029. We've just announced 8 with another 2 to shortly follow by 2027. That gives us a pool of 150 to 180 professional women players, which I think puts us ahead of any other country in the world in terms of development of the women's game. And that's really exciting for us.
Obviously, you've got the 102, which is another way in which fans can get into that sport. But the broadcast side of it is, sorry, just to clarify, is who's going to broadcast the women's competitions in this country?
Yeah, we've got existing broadcast contracts in place with Sky. We will also be, as the same way that we do with our county programme, looking to expand the streaming services. The streaming services that the counties have developed over the last few years have been exceptional. Whether it's through the ECB app, you can get every game on the ECB app, or whether it's through YouTube, it's brilliant. 6 or 7 cameras, amazing commentary teams with some extremely interesting and big names on some of those. So I think that will be the first instance. We know that getting exposure for the women's game is really important. When we look at the data, you know, we want to make sure that the women's game is regarded exactly on the same level as the men's. It is that broadcast exposure which is regarded as the most important critical piece at this point. So that we will certainly be focusing on that. And we want to grow the value of the women's game, both in terms of selling tickets, selling sponsorships, and selling broadcast deals. So, you know, we will be going all out to demonstrate that this really has value and has more value than perhaps historically has been ascribed. So next time we do go out to market, then we've got a fully fledged and really strong offering.
Is the WSL quite a good example here of the trajectory in which professional women's sports in this country can go? I mean, cycling back 5-6 years, what was BT, now TNT Sports, not very big rights deal, I think maybe just covering production costs, moves over to Sky and BBC, and the revenues immediately go up. This time they're expected to double, I think. But now with the creation of a new commercial body, which is going to be in charge of that, is that something that potentially, I mean, with the women's game, you've got such a big chance, it seems like, to redraw it in a completely different way. I think with men's sport, you're building from loads and loads of history. With women's sport, there's a chance to design it in a really modern way. Is that something that the ECB is thinking about?
It has to be designed in a modern way, but I don't think that we'd be looking to spin the women's game out separately, because we think we can get more investment in to the women's game if we aggregate all of the income coming into the whole game, and then we select our own strategic priorities for investment, whether that be the 100 or the women's game. And I think this is where we are different to other sports, in that everything comes under the ECB umbrella. So that's the England team, the domestic team, and grassroots. That means that, yes, there are debates that go on as to where the money should go, but all those debates are done within the same organisation. So we've got our strategy, Inspiring Generations, and we can refer back to that strategy when we're making those decisions on where the investment should come in. Because otherwise, my view is that the aggregation model allows us to invest more into the women's game and other areas than we otherwise would do if the money was coming in and only going in to fund the specific elements that the broadcast was linked to.
Yeah, I guess that's the jeopardy of like the Premier League model, for example, where you get into the situation like you have now with, as you said, arguments over who's paying for what. I'd like to go into the streaming side a little bit more. So currently counties can stream via the ECB app. The women's teams will get the chance to do that. Are you going to look at creating a whole ECB direct-to-consumer platform, revamping that entirely and putting a lot of the content on there as a sort of at least an early easy access point?
Yeah, we're developing on that. Currently during the Blast games, we consolidate all the content on a Friday night Blast program that we produce ourselves, and it flicks between the matches, and we can do that because all the central feeds are coming in. I think the technology has moved on so much over the last 10 years. And previously, you mentioned production in the past, it was the cost of production which was the limiting factor in terms of what you could do. Now that's not the case. You know, you can produce a pretty high quality feed for relatively small amounts of money, and therefore it's just much more achievable for us. And some of the numbers that we see are really quite impressive that are coming through. I think the higher those standards go, the easier it is for us to provide a consolidated program then that will be attractive. Very much looking at the EFL model with the new Sky deal. I was watching Bristol City the other day on the bonus stream. And I think that's really important that people are allowed to support and can support their team as often as possible, even if they can't get down to the ground. And I don't think it stops people going to the ground. In many ways, I think it just gives them a closer connection and is good for the clubs all around.
What's the thing you're most excited about in English cricket right now?
I am most excited about the growth and development of the women's game. Whether it started at schools in the 50s or 60s, but there were boys' sports and there were girls' sports, weren't there? And it was, you know, people were shoved down a particular line. And I think over the last 10 years, we've seen that change for the better. And what we're trying to do with cricket is to make sure that we can catch up for lost time, frankly, and overinvest into the women's game in order to try and make sure that cricket is the sport of choice for any aspiring girl or woman.
What's the biggest challenge that you are facing in ECB right now?
You know, the challenge is the breadth that we have to work through. Everything from international cricket, ICC, international relations, through to grassroots, 5,500 clubs, through to more informal types of cricket, tape ball, and trying to put more support in that. So our main challenge is the breadth that we've got to deal with and the relatively fixed amount of income that we've got to resource everything. So the most difficult decisions are always about, how do we cut our revenues? Where do we invest? At what particular time?
Okay. All right. That seems like a pretty good place to leave it. Richard, cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.